You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. The recorded books industry has taken off in the last two decades, more than doubling in size in the last 4 years alone. As audio services have expanded, the variety and availability has expanded as well. Obviously, this includes formats like the podcast, which you listeners are aware of, or you wouldn't be with us right now, but it's also included things like audio versions of newspapers. For example, Audible provides daily audio selections from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Here to talk to us today about reading the news, the audiobook industry, particularly the Canadian audiobook industry, is Jenny Hoops, one of the voices behind the Audible presentation of the Washington Post and dozens of full-length audiobooks. She lives in Bragg Creek, Alberta, Canada. Ms. Hoops, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Coyle. It is a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for inviting me.
And we were, just before we started recording, commiserating about having snow. I'm a little bit jealous about that. Our winter is over in Missouri, the little bit of it we got. So if you want to make our listeners jealous from your time in Canada, please feel free to do so now.
Well, I'm looking out my window at a new 4 inches of snow, which came on top of the foot of snow that was already in my yard. So my poor little rose bush, I have one lonely little hardy rose bush that is, I can see the top branches sticking out over the snow, and it'll be probably another 6 weeks before that snow disappears, and I might be able to plant something for my summer. I don't know how jealous you can be of that.
Well, I'm a little bit jealous of just from having grown up out west.
Nice.
Can we start by just having you give us a brief walkthrough of what it is that you do with the Washington Post for Audible?
Sure. So I'm a narrator, and that's my role. What I do for the Washington Post for that job is I am sent the scripts to read. So those are 10 stories that have been chosen by the Audible curation team from the Washington Post. They email those to me. And I read through them, I prepare those stories, and then I record them here in my home studio. Then those stories, the audio gets uploaded to the editors, a contractor who is just fantastic at doing this on a deadline. And then they go up on Audible for members to listen to. It's a really slick, organization. It's very quick. Everything comes through. It takes me to read. I generally have about an hour and 15 minutes to about an hour and a half of finished audio. So that's how long my stories finally run for. That will take me between 4 and 5 hours to research and record, and then I upload them. So it's basically a half a day's work for me once a week.
And I've got to say, you do an excellent job at this. But obviously, there is a political component to the act of recording. Keeping mm-hmm. your opinion out of your voice while you're reading these stories. I don't know. I don't know that I could do it. Honestly, I don't know that I could read a story and not let my love of or hatred of Justin Trudeau show through.
Exactly, like not inserting myself and my opinions is part of the job. My job is to convey the author's intentions, whether it's an audiobook or and I'm reading a character voice, or whether it's the Washington Post. I need to find the intention behind the author's words and make that come through in my voice. So there's no room for, you know, my little sarcastic comments or aught. Yeah, it's one of those things. I'm very fortunate that I get to read the Washington Post because it does align a lot with my own views, and so I don't have to, pretend to be somebody different. I get to pretend to be the author that wrote the work, and I'm conveying their intentions to the reader.
Actually kind of answers the question I was going to ask about reading the news articles versus the opinion pieces. I'm somewhat hesitant to criticize Audible because they're owned by Amazon and they're far more powerful than I am. But the Wall Street Journal has dropped the opinion pieces from their audio version, whereas the Washington Post has kept theirs. And maybe it's, stopped listening once they did that. So maybe they brought them back and I just don't know. Is there a difference for you between reading the news and reading the opinion? Do you feel sort of more flexible with one than the other?
Oh, of course there is, because an opinion piece is clearly the author is putting their opinion right out there, whereas a straight news piece often doesn't have those kinds of inflections. But of course, my intention is to convey the author's intention. And if it's an opinion piece that has a clear opinion in it, I'm of course going to take that and be the voice of that author and convey that too.
So. Now my wife instructed me to ask this, and I'm just sorry I didn't think of it first. How does one get the job reading the news?
I lucked into this one. I trained. I took a course in how to be a narrator, and then I started applying for work all over the place. Anybody that was producing audiobooks or any audio producers, I was sending them my resume basically. And the one contractor I sent a note to said, "Hey, well, we don't need any audiobook narrators right now, but we have this brand new project. It is reading periodicals. Would you be interested?" And I am so happy I lucked into that. It has been the most wonderful gig for a narrator, a steady gig. It's been going on 6 years now that I've been reading primarily the Washington Post, but like you mentioned, also the New York Times, some Wall Street Journal articles. I substitute for those. But it is through no fault of my own that I got the job, through not being a great voice or anything. I just happened to luck into it, and it's been really wonderful having that job.
I understand. I think every job I've had, I've kind of stumbled into, so I can sympathize.
I think that happens a lot more often than you think. For me, it's been a really good 6 years of training, because when the first year and a half, I actually did a daily show. So they did a morning and an afternoon edition. So I was the morning edition of the Washington Post. And for me, it just took a lot of time because, of course, I'm making sure that I'm using my standard American or general American accent every time. And I learned how to look up the pronunciation of names and places, which is a huge skill, which you may not have realized.
Yeah, I tend to just kind of power through and assume that I'll be corrected if someone knows I'm wrong.
I tell you, I used to do it that way as well. I just say, "Oh, well, someone will correct me." And then I realized that, it's my job to get it right the first time. And it's not really fair to lay that on an editor or a proofer who has to themselves look it up. I think it's my responsibility to look up how to say the word right. That's my job. That's what I do. And man, I am so good at Googling everything, every place name, everybody's name, because I always find that the only times I've gotten a lot of comments back on especially the Washington Post articles was when I have pronounced the name of somebody's town wrong. Oh, everybody wants to hear their small town pronounced the right way, or, attraction or whatever it is in their town that made the news. It should be pronounced correctly, and I think I really learned to give place names and people's names the respect they deserve when they're being narrated.
Sure, sure. And, well, and of course you're in a big public forum, whereas I'm 99% of the time in a classroom, so no one will know or care if I mispronounce it.
Well, you know what? It's and you know what? It that's the whole thing. Most people feel exactly that way too. So, but for me, I just feel a lot more responsibility to get it right and to give people that respect that, you know, to hear their name pronounced correctly or to hear the name of their hometown pronounced correctly means a lot to people. And it's interesting because when you draw people out of hearing a story, either because you've pronounced something wrong or you're not saying it in a conversational way, then people's comprehension of that story goes down, and they don't understand, they turn it off. So for me, everything always comes back to how the listener is enjoying the story, you know. And I don't want any part of what I'm saying cut them out of the story and draw them out because I've pronounced something wrong or I've said something incorrectly or I've emphasized the wrong word. For me, it's all about the listener and making sure that they're hearing the words that the author intended.
And maybe related to that, can you talk a little bit more about your work with the accent? Because presumably this is largely, you know, American newspapers and I assume a mostly American audience. And don't get me wrong, I would love to hear the Washington Post read in a Canadian accent, like full bore, but I realize you can't do that.
That actually is wise, because to hear something that where the listener is expecting an American accent, that's what they're familiar with, and that's what needs to be reading an American story. And so for me, that's just part of the job is learning how to say it in a way that the listener is expecting, so that they're not drawn away from the story just because of the way I'm saying something. So, yes, and that takes a while too. Yeah, I mean, it's all training, and it's all just being aware of the words you're reading and just doing a lot of research into how Canadians and Americans pronounce different words. But I find a lot of effort also goes into the international and the world stories that I read, because sure. Often there's a lot of names that are not very familiar, and it takes me a while to look up. And the way I look it up is I have to look for either audio, like a podcast, or a video where somebody says the word. And my goal every time is to try to have a person find a video of a person saying their own name, because that is definitive. They're like, clearly that's how they say their name. Second best is finding someone introducing that speaker, so they'll presumably they will have said their name correctly as they're introducing them. So those are my those are the things I look for. But I think the best one I ever looked up was the name of when President Obama was opening a new marine park near Hawaii in the Pacific Ocean, and it's the Papahanaumokuakea Marine Park. And Papahanaumokuakea, I thought, I am so proud of being able to not only read that the first time well, but I remember it was probably 5 years ago that I did that story.
Sure.
I still remember how to say it.
I will not try to repeat that. I do appreciate the work you put into that. Most of the names I pronounce are, you know, people who've been dead for centuries. So there's less pressure there to get that. So I really appreciate the time you put into that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Did you want to mention anything else about Audible or the Washington Post? Otherwise we'll transition here into the bigger audio industry.
Oh, sure. Well, I guess Audible is really, and this is a good way to transition too into the larger industry. Audible is of course the giant in the audiobook and audio industry. They're huge. I believe they're about 80% of the retail market. It's important for every single author who wants their audiobook to sell. They must have it on Audible. Audible is really expanding their reach. They're opening in more and more countries. I believe there are now 8 countries where Audible is available, and hopefully more. I mean, it's always good. They do a really good job promoting audiobooks to the world and just making sure they are behind the big growth and the big drive of audiobooks in general.
Yeah, and we're now on territory where I am completely ignorant. So you're going to have to kind of blaze the way through here. Obviously, sure. Audible is now an Amazon company, so it makes sense that there's some size behind it.
Yeah. That happened quite a while ago. I don't know the exact year, but at least 10 or 12 years ago, right. It seems to me that Amazon purchased Audible, and I think Audible really benefited from that that parent company, because they could then use Amazon's huge reach to get bigger. So I think it's been a good thing for Amazon and Audible.
Well, I'm assuming that, again, our listeners are probably audiobook listeners. Just by virtue of listening to podcasts, you kind of put yourself in that listening to spoken content on whatever you use. But what do you think our listeners most need to know about the audiobook industry?
I think that the places they can get audiobooks has expanded just exponentially, even in the last 2 or 3 years. They don't just have to go to Audible and become an Audible member and download. There's probably 25 different distributors that they can have easy access to. It's just growing and growing and growing and growing. And every distributor has got their own niche that they're looking out for. For example, one place that Audible doesn't go is into libraries. So if someone wants to go to their library and download an audiobook through that, then they're going to be using different apps like Overdrive or Hoopla. And Audible doesn't go into that market. So that's a huge place for expansion for the other distributors to find their niche and make sure that they're servicing the whole wide world. And again, Audible is only in, and I wish I knew the number, I think it's 8 countries. The rest of the world is open for people who want to listen to audiobooks in other languages. It's huge. I think every 6 months that I have been doing audiobooks, for 6 years, the entire market has changed. Every 6 months, it's a whole new game for where you can sell audiobooks and where you can promote audiobooks, how you can get people to buy audiobooks. It's just an amazingly mobile market.
I didn't realize that. I mean, I knew that. I didn't realize Audible didn't go into libraries. Like, I knew libraries used Overdrive or Hoopla or the various services. Mm-hmm. I just assumed those were sort of front companies for Audible. And that there was some kind of team up of providing content through these shell corporations. That makes it sound sinister.
It's entirely different companies. Now, Audible really has worked on their subscription model is how they are mostly selling books. They do some a la carte sales, but for the most part, they're focused on getting members and having memberships. Listeners, so that model just doesn't work for libraries who are distributing through their own. So what you might find is if you're keen on finding an audiobook, you may not be able to find it at your library because they don't have whoever is producing that audiobook may not have distributed to the library distributors. But and there's some, you know, and this has gone on for several years. There's quite a bit of back and forth going on between libraries and Audible about copyright and how much a library should pay for a book that they're lending. How many loans can a library, how many times can a library lend an audiobook before they need to pay for another copy of it? And that's been an industry discussion for several years at least. And libraries are always in that zone of having to pay for books that they need to distribute.
Right. And I suspect there are some demographic issues there at work as well. I have no scientific grounding for this, but my gut says that the sorts of people who use libraries tend to be the older crowd and the parents of, you know, fairly young children crowd, whereas those also tend to be the sorts of people who don't use Audible as much. But maybe that's just my prejudice or who I see when I'm actually at the library.
Exactly. You see what you know. I think it's also between the United States and Canada, it's quite different. Canadians tend to use libraries more. And so we have an even more difficult relationship between audiobook distributors and libraries, because the audiobook distributors understand that they might be losing some sales to libraries. So there's, but I think that's a conflict that has always been going on. Even print, like print books, were facing that same copyright issue with libraries lending it out and having to buy copies. A library will always pay more for their copy because it's intended for multiple loans rather than a single person buying it at the bookstore or going to Audible and buying an audiobook. So, and you know what, I'm sure that's an argument that will continue between libraries and audio publishers, you know, for millennia. This is just the way of libraries, is they lend out material and there's a negotiation about how much they should pay for that. Always.
Well, how has the technology changed? How have the technology changes in the industry affected what you do? Whether like your actual recording side of it or what you see in the market. I mean, we've gone from CDs to those little portable MP3 players that libraries used to have to now just streaming.
And now it's all digital download. Right. Well, and the transformation has been quicker than you might imagine. Only 5 years ago, digital download audiobooks were probably 80% of the market. So this is Audible coming online and in more countries and pushing it. Right. And the last year that they've got data for, the data for 2019 says that digital downloads were 98.5% of all audiobook sales. There's literally nothing else than going and downloading an audiobook online.
I assume that other 1.5% is just the margin of error.
I don't think so. No, because there are still audiobooks being produced on CD, like hard copies, and then there's some streaming services that are coming online, but they're not as big. But the hard copy market is really interesting, because that is where a lot of people who are visually impaired need to get their audiobooks from. In Canada and in the United States, there's a lot of organizations devoted to providing audio content for visually impaired people. In Canada, it's the CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, And in the United States, there's Learning Ally and LibriVox. There's a few.
My information is a bit old on this, but once upon a time, the Library of Congress would come out with audiobooks for the blind. They had like special readers, special devices that they would play them on. I forget the name of the organization. There's someone who produced hard copies on tape, like old cassette tapes for prisons.
Oh yeah, that's right. You have books on tape.
Yeah, well, because you can't turn it into a shovel or a weapon or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because those specialty audiobooks for the visually impaired have embedded in them some markers and it has extra detail in them so that a visually impaired person who is listening to a textbook, for example, will still have all the footnotes and be able to scroll around their audiobook and be able to find it. So they're a market that still really needs hard copies or at least something, even an MP3, that is specially prepared so that it does have all these markers that they can use to navigate through their audiobook and go back and forth. Because a great big long textbook is really, really hard for somebody to learn from if they can't set markers and go back and reread sections, re-listen to sections that they need help with. So yeah, where audiobooks used to be just for the blind, you know, books on tape or books on tape for the blind, now it's really more a convenience and a lifestyle type of reading that people are doing. So rather than just as an asset for blind people, it is now for everyone. And, it's really interesting. People are reading more, people who have never read as much before because they're reading through audiobook. They are like if there's somebody who was a truck driver, for example. They would never have been able to read as many books as they can read now because now they're reading them aloud and they're listening to the audiobook portion.
I don't know that I'd ever thought of audiobooks as just for the blind, possibly because of when I grew up, but mostly just because of living in the West. If you're driving anywhere, you're going to be driving for at least 4 hours and the radio station's not going to hold up. So
Yeah. Well, I guess some... The very first audiobooks, like books on tape, and there was even like records, record players that you could, you know, put different books on and listen. And those date back to the 1940s and 1950s. And as the technology, you know, became more portable, that's when everything started to really blossom. Now they can take it with them. But by the same token, how many cars have you been in lately that had a CD player?
Just mine.
Just yours. And it's probably pretty old. There's almost no cars that come with CD players anymore. And so that is also driving the how many books are now available only as digital downloads? Because people don't even have CD players anymore.
Right. It is always kind of interesting when I'm traveling across country, which of course with COVID we haven't done as much of that, but to kind of keep an eye out at truck stops and restaurants, places that rent or sell the audiobooks, like where they're at. Which maybe I'm just stopping at the places with the older population, the Cracker Barrels and what have you. But so far, they do still have CDs, but there also seem to be fewer places.
Yeah, like I say, they do make them, so they are available. But it's getting to the point where you need to special order a CD, and then they're almost print on demand CDs that are made for you if you want to buy them. So there's almost no publishers right now that are printing a stock of CD audiobooks because so few people are even asking for them now.
Well, what else do you think people should think about when they're looking into the audio industry?
Well, this might be a little self-serving, but I really, really want people to start looking at indie authors, little known authors who you may not have ever heard before. Well, like, what a great opportunity to start hearing and listening to new voices and new ideas. We have the big five publishers and the big audiobook publishers, and of course they're going to publish all the really, you know, top New York Times bestsellers. But I think it's wonderful to be able to go and listen to a new author you've never heard of, maybe somebody local who's just gotten into audiobooks, and it's become more egalitarian. It's easier now to find an audiobook of a brand new author because this is Audible has made it possible through they have an indie marketplace where authors can meet up with narrators called ACX, and so you can easily produce an audiobook with you know, very little cost, and I think everybody should just go try and explore some of those. There are really a lot of gems out there that are underappreciated.
I'll ask you for some recommendations for that in a second. But can you talk a little? So, with I guess the equivalent in the print world would be like self-published books or small indie presses. I've certainly read some good self-published books. The vast majority of the self-published books I've read have been self-published for quality reasons, I think. And that's probably about as nice as I can say it. I assume that's not true in the audio world. Otherwise you wouldn't be telling us to do that, but can you maybe talk about why should we expect the quality of an indie audio book to be higher than the self-published, you know, novel my cousin wrote?
Well, you know what? That same problem plagues every industry where people are able to just publish their own stuff. So yeah, of course, there's going to be the awful sounding audiobooks that sound like somebody was trying to record them in their toilet. There's always going to be those mass-produced bad audiobooks, but the industry right now, the production side, has almost entirely gone to home studio narrating rather than having to drive into a big studio and have a producer and a director and everybody sitting around watching me through a glass screen. A huge percent is now just done through home studios. And there's so many of us who have invested in some decent equipment and really made sure that our recording studio sounds really good. And you can't tell the difference between most home studios now and what a big publisher might do in a studio you have to drive into and go do that. But it really is the plague of the industry, of every industry, where everybody thinks they can just do an audiobook. And so they use the microphone on their laptop and they record in their closet or something. And you can tell pretty early on in the audiobook if that's how it was recorded. You can listen to the 5-minute sample on Audible before you even buy it, and you can tell the quality difference is there. So, you know, shop around a little bit and you'll be able to find the really good quality ones, like mine.
I think I've only listened to your Washington Post stuff, but it's high quality. So can you point our listeners towards you can do either, you know, indie publishers or specific books that you'd recommend, and feel free to promote yourself here, things you read if you want to.
Oh, you're very kind. And this is where I get really excited about some of the authors that I have worked for, because they're fantastic stories. And One in particular, two actually, that I have done multiple books for is two women, one who's a Florida native, another one who is in North Carolina. And Sarah Schaber is just has the most wonderful mystery series called Louise Purley Mysteries. And they are fantastic books, like great plots and interesting characters and really well written. The stories are fantastic. And, you know, as a murder mystery, the surprises are all there. So Sarah Schaber is one I highly recommend. And then another author I've read several of her books is Iris Chacon. And Iris, I really enjoy her books because she is such a proponent of anybody who has a disability. She wants to show them in her books as being completely competent and able and not the object of pity. And so often the heroes and the heroines in her books are people who have disabilities. And so I'm really fond of her books for that reason, because it really shows disabled people in a strong, positive light. So Iris's latest book that I did the audio for is called The Mammoth Murders, and it's the second in a series for her. But in that one, again, the proponent or the hero of the story is a blind DJ who manages to, you know, rescue his fiance from the jaws of an alligator. You know, like really, really interesting, fun, and exciting stuff. And it involves real people. So, both those authors are I love reading their books. The other thing you should be asking me is how I manage to read in the voices of all the characters in the book.
Okay, how do you manage to read the voices? Assuming they're not all set in Western Canada, how do you manage to read the voices?
Oh, that's right. Well, you know what? When I'm reading a book of fiction, it is an acting job. And so I'm not just an actor, you know, playing one part. I'm actually being all of the characters and coming up with all the voices. So for me, that takes a lot of preparation before I even start recording. Is, you know, I have a great big spreadsheet. I read through the manuscript. I have a spreadsheet of you know, who are the characters who talk? Are they male, female, old, young? Do they have, has the author written them with an accent of any kind? And so I have to learn that accent. For me, the struggle has always been to do a child's voice. I can do a man's voice. I can do an old woman, an old man. But for me, children's voices are a little bit tough. So I always have to practice those. But like I say, it's a lot of preparation. I have a massive spreadsheet. And the most different, there's some books you read where there's very few characters who speak in the book that you have to give a voice to. I've read some with as few as 30 or 40 characters, but some are every character will say something. And then you'll have like 200 or 300 characters that you have to try to devise a unique voice for as much as you can. Like some are minor characters that you can just use, you know, old man voice or something like that. But when you have your fallback voices that you can do, so you can do an old woman in Texas. Well, I use my old woman accent with a Texas accent attached to it, and boom, I have a character. But my system fell apart a little bit with one book I did where there was a group of old women in a nursing home in Texas. And so I had one old woman Texas voice, but I needed four. So I had to, yeah. And the thing is, when someone is listening to an audiobook, you have to make sure the characters are distinctive so that they know who's talking in the book without having to stop and rewind and figure it out. So it's it's really important that you get the characters correct, that you get them distinctive, and that you follow through the entire book using the same accent and the same voice. So, if you don't have a spreadsheet, you can lose track of your characters really fast.
And again, this is a world of which I know nothing. So this is all fascinating to me, I think. Does it matter when you're reading, does it matter what kind of book you're reading, what genre, nonfiction, fiction, you know, horror, mystery, whatever, how does that affect what you do?
Oh, it's really important, because every genre has the voice that people are looking for when they listen to it. So, for example, fantasy or romance have different approaches to even how fast the narrator reads, the inflections they give to their voice. So as a narrator, you need to be aware of the genre that you're reading so that you can match that genre-specific style of reading. It's actually quite important.
What's the thing that you've read that's your favorite? Either in terms of, you know, you just thought it was the best book, or you had the most fun reading it?
Well, I really think, and this is so bad, I actually love the book that I just finished reading more. Like, and you could ask me at any point, which is your favorite book? And I will tell you, it was this one. It was fantastic. I loved it, because I actually almost have to fall in love with every book, every character I'm reading, before I do a really good job at narrating it. And so I carry that love of the characters and the love of the story with me until I get the next book. And then I have to fall in love with a whole new set of characters on the next book.
I think that was the mystery writer, Kinky Friedman. Someone asked him what his favorite of his books was. And he said, well, it's the one I'm currently writing. It's always the one I'm currently writing.
It's always the one I'm writing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know exactly what he means. It's the one I just finished, is the one I love the most.
Anything else, since it looks like we're kind of approaching our time, anything else you want to say about recording audiobooks, listening to audiobooks, the audiobook industry? If you want to zero in on Canadian audiobooks, you and I had talked briefly about that earlier.
Right. Well, let's see. The Canadian audiobook industry is probably 10 years behind the American industry, just because we have, you know, 1/9 the population, and so it's just not as vibrant an industry yet. But it's coming, and I'm certainly happy to see that. But I think for the listeners who are really interested in audiobooks, all I can say is just go keep trying some new and different audiobooks. Take the time to explore and listen to them and send feedback. Every author, every narrator should know what you think of their audiobook, because there's no other way to get better. There's no other way to get more of what you are hoping to hear than if you give us feedback.
I will admit, I have absolutely no idea how to give feedback to a reader of an audiobook.
Well, it's really easy, because every time you finish a book from Audible, you get, would you like to rate this book?
And you okay, so just through the system, right? Not like,
yeah, you can see the system. You know, it's easy enough as well to look up an author or look up a narrator's name, Google it, and send them an email. I'm absolutely available, and occasionally do get emails from people asking about my books.
Well, anything else? Otherwise, we'll call it there.
I think that's about everything I have to say. Like I said, listen to more books and let us know how you think.
Well, hey, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. I appreciate it. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed it. Hopefully you did too. I'm sure our listeners will.
Oh, I had a great time. You know what? You've asked me all these really good questions, and I had to look up beforehand I've done an awful lot of exploration just because you showed an interest, and I really appreciate that, Coyle.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to come on. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high